It's Remembrance Sunday, the 8th of November 2015, the 26th of Cheshvan 5776, and on 558 AM, digital radio, online, and as a podcast. This is Sunday Jewish Radio on Spectrum Radio. I'm Phil Dave. Coming up, the UK Jewish Film Festival started last night, and so to find out what is coming up for this year's event, I've been speaking to Michael Etherton, the CEO of UK Jewish Film. He'll tell us about the highlights and where you'll find the various films in about 25 minutes' time. Our main story on Sunday Jewish Radio this week, of which we'll hear more about in the news with Viv in just a moment, is that Willesden Cemetery has been granted £320,000 to restore the historic site. To tell us about how that money will be spent and why it matters in the first place will be the new Heritage Chief of the United Synagogue, Alex Goldberg. That's in about 15 minutes' time. And on Round Table, the subject of Jewish burial grounds. Now, this might sound a bit morbid, but the Willesden story has got us thinking about what cemeteries mean to us. I will join Clive Roslin this week, along with our guests, journalist and author Emma Klein, and the voice that is Mr. Jeremy Jacobs. But before all of that, with a roundup of the Jewish news stories from the past week, here's Vivian Krieger.
The Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn has condemned Sir Gerald Kaufman's remarks about Jewish financial donations influencing Conservative Party policy on Israel as unacceptable and deeply regrettable. Sir Gerald, who's the MP for Manchester Gorton, made his comments during a meeting in Parliament. The Community Security Trust, the Board of Deputies and the Jewish Leadership Council wrote to Labour's Chief Whip, Rosie Winterton MP, to request swift and appropriate disciplinary action against him. Mr. Corbyn also said the remarks damaged community relations and did nothing to benefit the Palestinian cause. In Tel Aviv, the former US President Bill Clinton led tributes to the assassinated Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin on the 20th anniversary of his death. He told thousands of Israelis gathered in Rabin Square that the day he was killed was probably the worst day of his presidency. The two men, who were good friends, worked together on the Oslo Accords, which Israel signed with Yasser Arafat. And there's been more violence in Israel, with a 70-year-old man stabbed in Netanya and two men in their 20s and 30s attacked with knives in Rishon LeZion, south of Tel Aviv. An 80-year-old woman was left fighting for her life after being stabbed in the back at a bus station. In Poland, it's been reported that the graves of Holocaust victims at the Sobibor extermination camp have been plundered by treasure hunters. Staff at the camp's museum claim they found signs of disturbances at the graves, which were close to the site of one of the gas chambers. Archaeologists working on a project there said they'd found lots of pits which clearly hadn't been professionally dug, and suspected thieves were looking for gold and metal. The chief executive of the Holocaust Educational Trust, Karen Pollock, said whoever did it showed a complete disregard for the atrocities that happened at Sobibor. Up to 250,000 people were believed to have been murdered there between 1942 and 1943. The United Synagogue has been given more than £320,000 to restore Willesden Cemetery, one of London's most important Victorian Jewish landmarks. The money, which has come from the Heritage Lottery Fund, is part of a £2 million grant that will pay for renovations, as well as for a new visitor centre, a permanent exhibition, and an online educational project. Willesden contains many notable graves, including those of Julius Vogel, the first Jewish Prime Minister of New Zealand, Lionel de Rothschild, the first Jewish Member of Parliament, the scientist Rosalind Franklin, who helped discover DNA, and Jack Cohen, the founder of Tesco's. And finally, up to 120 motorists who were issued with penalty charge notices for parking outside Kinloss, Finchley United Synagogue, have been told they can claim refunds after Transport for London admitted they'd been served incorrectly. Over-eager traffic wardens issued the fines along Charter Way between November 2014 and April 2015, thinking the road was part of a TfL network of designated arterial routes through the capital, when in fact it isn't. Clear as mud. And that's the news this week.
Thank you, Viv. And it's time now when Diana Turman joins me, Clive Roslin, in the studio to review this week's Jewish newspapers. Diana, first to the front pages.
Let's start, Clive, with the Jewish Chronicle. And there is a large headline which says, "The Great Escape Revealed, the Mission to Save the Last Jews of Aleppo." This is something the JC are doing actually quite a long time after the event. They say they can now reveal the extraordinary story of how the last Jews of Aleppo in Syria were smuggled out of their home in a daring rescue mission earlier this year. This family were absolutely petrified, and they were sure that it was Bashar al-Assad who'd come for them as three men entered the house. And they were allowed only to take one bag with them of personal possessions, and that got out, you know, within minutes into a minibus. And only then did the truth dawn on them that the rescuers who burst in with such force had actually come to rescue them.
That's an amazing story, isn't it?
It is an amazing story. Oh. Presumably, they must have been so terrified that it just didn't dawn on them until ages later.
When you think of the Germans at the time of the Nazis, they sent all the Jews off with only one case to the concentration camps.
They did.
And it's got, you know, you can understand
where
they felt.
It has resonances, yes. It has very similar resonances. Oof. Yes, it does.
The Jewish News is front pages, what we've already heard in the news, about Corbyn laying into Kaufman over his offensive, to quote the Jewish News, Jewish money slur, which is not surprising because I think it's really extraordinary that the Labour MP Kaufman made all these remarks about Jewish money.
Right, maybe we'll follow that story through. This one is from the Jewish News, and it's about synagogues who are being urged to gain youth appeal. And it's actually a New Yorker who is a research professor of Jewish social policies in New York who has put forward this theory that the vitality of synagogues will be reinforced by keeping the young people on board. And one of the synagogues they actually looked at were, well, several synagogues, come to think of it, were Kinloss Gardens, which is United, New North London, which is Masorti, and Aylith Gardens, which is Reform. And they used surveys, observation, and face-to-face meetings and decided that there should be significant investment in youth programming and that the synagogue should consider placing social services professionals in congregations to help deal with demographic changes. I'm just wondering why you would want social service professionals to deal with demographic changes. Surely you'd want a sociologist to do that, not a social service professional. Anyway,
it seems
an odd thing, doesn't it?
Very odd.
To put social services in the synagogues.
That's extraordinary. Anyway, there's something rather similar to that in the Jewish Chronicle. It says six of the best model communities across the country. And it says all these synagogues are doing terribly well. And there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. Northwestern Reform, Bet Hamidrash in Leeds, Bronsbury Park in London, Finchley United, known as the Kinloss, which you've just mentioned, Menorah, Cheshire Reform Congregation, and the New North London, which is the UK's largest Masorti shul with 1,200 households. And it says that membership growth is up to 5% a year. And so they're all very, very good.
That's an award given by whom?
It's not an award. I think it's just the Jewish Chronicle who's saying these are the six best model communities across the country.
Oh, I see. They've conducted some sort of survey. Right. Now then, we get back to this awful Russian plane crash in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh. And one of the people who was killed was a very pretty girl called Anna Tishinskaya, who was a former Hillel program director, apparently, in Russia, and she was one of the 224 passengers who died on the plane bound for St. Petersburg that crashed over Egypt. And there's a little article here and a lot of people writing in to say how wonderful she was.
Oh, that's sad. The Jewish Chronicle has an article which is very interesting, which is headed, "Heard the one about the Pope, Jesus, and the anti-Semite," and it's all about the fact that a number of Latin American Jews visited the Pope, and they were looking very much forward to it. because they know how pro-Semite he is, and they knew that they'd receive a warm reception from the pontiff. But well, what they didn't expect was to hear him tell a joke about an anti-Semitic Catholic priest.
Good heavens.
And according to Claudio Empelman, who's the executive director of the Latin American Jewish Congress, the joke went like this. One day during his sermon, the priest found a way to attack Jews, as usual, in a vicious way. During a pause, Jesus got down from his cross, looked at the Virgin Mary and said, "Let's get out of here, Mum. They don't seem to like us."
Well, you read it in the paper, so it must be true. Extraordinary story. Now, this is a much more serious one. This is about Twitter. A Jewish student union officer suffered a barrage of anti-Semitic abuse on social media after tweeting a photo of a Hitler poster displayed on her campus. She's the education officer at the University of Birmingham Guild of Students, and she posted a photograph of the poster, and this poster showed an image of Hitler with the words, "Hitler was right," in order to highlight the problem of anti-Semitism, but I'm afraid it seriously backfired,
as
it so often does with these things, because she just got tweet after tweet after tweet supporting Hitler, denigrating her, and everything else.
Oh, that's a very sad story. There's a happier one in the Jewish news, and it says, "Jews and Muslims unite for Mitzvah Day." Young Jews and Muslims across North London have teamed up for Mitzvah Day to help a charity obtain samples from potential stem cell or bone marrow donors. The Mixed Faith team will pack hundreds of spit kits on 24th of November for the Anthony Nolan Trust, which matches donors to those needing life-saving transplants. There's a very good story, that, I think.
What, just explain to me again what a spit kit is.
Was what to give?
Oh, they need the saliva for the DNA or whatever in the saliva. Yeah. Now this is an extraordinary story. It's about a night of theatre. Well, that's not the extraordinary bit. It's the venue that was unusual. It's Jane Meyer's home. The venue was actually her house, and the Edgware Synagogue member was one of 30 people chosen to take part in Theatre Royal Stratford East's Home Theatre Project. Performers devise a tailor-made one-person show based on the stories of the host family. So it's not a documentary exactly, as far as I can gather. She says, "It was amazing. We started in the garden, moved to the kitchen and ended in the lounge."
So it was a sort of life.
I think it was a sort of day in the life type thing.
Yeah.
How extraordinary.
Two very, I thought, very amusing stories from the JC. First one is, in USA, Jews eat pork. A new Pew Research Center survey on American religion released this week revealed that 37% of Jews in the United States eat pork. Overall, however, the poll showed that American Jews are becoming more religious, not less. And the other one is, I'm sorry, it's not the Messiah. Some visitors to the Kotel were jubilant this week when they saw water seeping out of the wall. According to the Bible, water will gush out of the house of the Lord when the Messiah comes. But it emerged, however, that it wasn't the Messiah. It was just a water pipe had burst.
Oh, what an anticlimax. Now, here's a nice little piece to round us off this week. Radio 4 has actually asked New North London Synagogue to host Gardener's Question Time later this month. That's a novel thing. It's never been done before. The idea to apply to be a venue for the popular radio show came from the green-fingered member who tends the synagogue's garden, who's called Hazel Stein. So that should be interesting. Mm. I don't know how big the garden is. I don't think it's all that big, but still.
That's a nice one. Diana, thank you. More from you same time next week. Our main story on Sunday Jewish Radio is that Willesden Cemetery has been granted £320,000 in order to refurbish and restore the historic site. Fiddler's been speaking to the new heritage chief of the United Synagogue, Alex Goldberg, to find out how that money will be spent. He started by asking Alex to tell us about the significance of Willesden Cemetery.
So Willesden Cemetery is unique. It's a Victorian cemetery that was opened in 1873. And what's unique about Willesden is that it has 20,000 graves, but amongst those are 200 celebrities, and we have the biographies of 900 people in that cemetery through obituaries. And those people in the cemeteries have made a huge difference to not only our Jewish community, but Britain as a whole. So from politics, we have the first Jewish Prime Minister of New Zealand, Julius Vogel, who wasn't well, came over to England and was treated. Is in the cemetery. We have the first Jewish MP, as a Rothschild, and we have the first Jewish member of the House of Lords, who's his son. We have Rosalind Franklin, who was one of the discoverers of DNA, and at the moment in the West End, Photo 51, which is the story of her life, is captured audiences and you can't buy a ticket. We have the founders of various businesses, Jack Cohen from Tesco's. We have the founder of Shell Oil. We have many chief rabbis there and a number of others. We also have, right in the centre of the ground, Hannah Roseberry, and she's interesting. She was, at the age of 24, the wealthiest woman in Britain, in the Victorian Britain. She brought Gladstone back to power, convinced Gladstone to make her husband Foreign Secretary. She did a lot of philanthropic work in the East End and in Scotland, where her husband's estate was. And she died at 39, but she had already elevated her husband to power, and a few years later he became Prime Minister.
So the long and the short of it is that there's one or two rather well-known names in that cemetery. So that alone should indicate its significance.
It's got great historic significance, but also with Heritage Lottery Fund, we're looking at the people's history as well. We want the lives of ordinary people buried there. So whilst there are some fantastic and extraordinary lives, we also want to look at what were the ambitions, the hopes of Anglo-Jewry, both in the Victorian and early 20th century. There are still people being buried there today. A more recent burial was Michael Winner, and his gravestone was designed by a 3-times Academy Award winning set designer. So there we have these nuances in the cemetery too.
That actually was going to be my next question, is whether or not it's still actively used or whether or not it is now full to capacity. So I didn't realise that, so there you have it.
The cemetery is technically closed before everyone wants to transfer to Willesden, but there are some places available on strict reservation, but it's getting towards being full. I understand there are about 25 funerals there a year.
Goodness, in comparison to Bushy, which feels like 25 a week.
But right, it's not that many, but you're correct.
Well, as far as Willesden Cemetery is concerned, it's obviously recently been awarded this grant of £320,000, I believe. Mm-hmm. Where's that money come from?
So the initial development grant is from the Heritage Lottery Fund, and it's been approved by their London board. This is a development grant, so they've given us 2 years to develop our plans. The proposal we put in is a bigger project of 2.5 million, and we applied for a £2 million grant. So you get an initial grant to develop the site, and then if all goes well, they'll give you the rest of the money to deliver that project. So we're looking in the next 2 years, and we're bringing in a number of consultants at conserving the gravestones. There are some that have fallen to disrepair, looking at conserving the buildings. We also want this to be a people's project, so we want to have education at the heart of it. We're looking at seminars, a seminar room in what is the lodge, the gatehouse, or in one of the prayer halls. And we also want a digital online exhibition as well. There's discussion of whether there might be little QR code readers next to small sticks next to the graves.
Is that within religious law? Is that allowed?
Yeah, apparently so. We're going to look. That's what we've been given the great opportunity to do, to look at different plans, consult with communities, and to also consult with religious authorities, which we work for the United Synagogue, are not far, the Beth Din are not far away. But we understand the QR codes are fine. We've also looked at, there is a inexpensive way of giving people audio guides as well, which have been used in graveyards in Israel. So we're actually adapting that technology and maybe bringing it to England. So there are different models that we're already looking at, and I think over the next 2 years that will solidify. But that's our plan. We want to commemorate and celebrate the lives there. But it's not just about the past. It's about, yes, it's about our past. It's about your present, and it's also about their future. We want people from communities being involved. We want them to understand where we've come from, how we look at them in a contemporary light, and where the Jewish community is going to. And in addition to that, we want to reach out to schools and the general population to educate about Judaism, our rituals, our lives, and the people that were part of this community and made it happen. In a world perhaps that's become a bit skeptical about migration and immigrants, some of the people who are interred in Willesden were migrants who achieved amazing things. As a community, Willesden itself is this sort of Victorian image put together by Anglo-Jewry of what a Victorian Jewish cemetery would look like, taking the best parts of Britain whilst staying traditional to Orthodox Judaism. One thing we've already discovered and we put in the bid, it's worth mentioning, is that there was something called a Hotus Eudorium, a Jew's garden, which got destroyed during the war, I think, to do with rationing. Also, Willesden was hit badly by the Luftwaffe, destroying one of the Rothschild mausoleums. But at the end of the war, there was no Jew's garden. We have a list of flora in our records. Some of it's very Victorian flora, and maybe not suitable today. But Heritage Lottery Fund are excited that we're going to at least put examples of the Jew's garden back into Willesden.
Picking up on what you said before about QR codes, audio guides, and things like that, there may be some people listening to this now who think it sounds like you're almost turning Willesden Cemetery into a bit of a tourist attraction, for want of a better term. Is that not a bit distasteful, disrespectful to people's families who actually are buried there?
We wouldn't want to be disrespectful in any way whatsoever. Our hope is by having a sustainable form of heritage, one where people are going to visit, that Willesden will stay in a pristine condition for decades, if not centuries, to come. I would point out now that the 19th, 20th century cemetery in Berlin is one of the top visitor attractions in Berlin. The top visitor attraction in Berlin is the Jewish Museum, but there are several hundred thousand visitors that go there. We're not that cemetery. The cemetery in Prague is also one of the top visitor attractions in Prague, if not the top visitor attraction. And that's been done in a sensitive way. We know people involved in heritage, culture, and the museum's world in Berlin and in Prague, and we'll be taking their advice as well. Our fundamental belief is that we have to respect the dead, but letting a cemetery, and there are many cemeteries in the UK which are in decline and their heritage is at serious threat, including many Jewish cemeteries, certainly in outlying areas. And we want to build a model for Willesden that it will be kept in the pristine condition that we would like to see it for a very long time to come. And I think this is the way to do it.
And just finally, speaking as the relative of great-grandparents are actually buried in Willesden, is any of the onus going to fall upon the descendants of the families who are buried there? Do they have to fork out anything for this?
No, the United Synagogue has always said that part of the burial agreement that people have, that the upkeep of various people's graves are incumbent on the families themselves. In many ways, what we will do will take some of this away, but we are still expecting families to keep up their own graves. Unfortunately, there are many families who don't have descendants and relatives, and even if they do, they're not living in this country, or they're four or five generations down the line now, and some people are not even aware that their relatives are in Willesden. We would like to engage people in this project. Maybe it's not a cost thing, but we'd also like to form a very large volunteer corps, not only a volunteer corps which shows people around the cemetery, but a volunteer corps that will maintain the cemetery and the gardens and the exhibitions for many years to come. So there are many ways that people can become involved. It's not just a checkbook way. We want people to actually embrace their heritage and help preserve it. And I think that's what Steve Pat, the president of the United Synagogue, said this week, that he wants the communities to become involved. If our children don't take an interest in who we are, where we've come from, where we are today as a result of it, and where we're going, then this project is not pointless, but it loses much of its emphasis. This is about engaging people with the heritage and, as I said, ensuring that heritage and that your ancestors' graves for many years to come. And that's the whole point of this project. But to be given an honest answer, yes, we're still looking for families to have the upkeep of their graves, if possible. because that was the original agreement, and that helps keep Willesden and other cemeteries that we run going.
Alex Goldberg speaking to me there about the £320,000 grant that's just been awarded to Willesden Cemetery to see the historic site restored and refurbished. Don't forget, if you would like to comment on any of the stories that you hear on Sunday Jewish Radio, you are welcome to do so. You can email us on studio@sundayjewishradio.co.uk, and we can also be contacted via social media. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/Sunday Jewish Radio, and on Twitter, we are @SundayJRadio. Now, last night, that's Saturday evening, saw the start of the UK Jewish Film Festival 2015. It features an array of different cinematic pleasures, and so to find out what's in store for this year's event, I've been speaking to Michael Etherton, the CEO of UK Jewish Film. Now, you'll have to excuse the racket that goes on in the background. I'm afraid that I was only able to speak to him in a rather noisy coffee shop. But all the same, I started by asking him to remind us a bit about the history of the festival.
Well, the UK Jewish Film Festival was founded in 1997 by Judy Ironside. Actually, it was in Brighton that the festival was founded, the Brighton Jewish Film Festival. And that was 19 years ago. And over the years, it has mutated and developed into the fabulous national festival that we have today, very, very luckily.
I love the choice of words, mutated into. Mm-hmm. Does that describe a little bit from within how you feel that sometimes the pressure of the festival could be, perhaps?
It's certainly a very pressurized environment, but we view that as really healthy. As we get closer to the annual festival, we're incredibly busy. We're really proud to put on such a large and diverse festival, but doing that with a small team takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication. But we're really passionate about what we do, and we love bringing our films and events to our audiences.
So why not tell us about some of that work? Credit those people that you work with right now. Who are your team made up of, and what exactly do you have to do to put the festival together?
Well, we have a fabulous team with, of course, our founder and president, Judy Ironside, founded us 19 years ago. And then we also have our business director, who's Karen Misgav. Our lovely film programmer, Nicola Christie, has to watch many hundreds of films each year.
It sounds torturous.
It's absolutely torturous. No, it's 500 or 600 films each year. And from that enormous amount of submissions, we will select around about 80 for our festival. And then we have a small team beyond that, Elise Loiseau and Elisa Timoshkina, who is our operations coordinator.
So you might be forgiven for not recognising, listening at home, to how many people are actually involved in putting the festival together and what goes into it. How does the actual selection process work? You say that you go through hundreds of films and then have to choose about 80. What's the criteria you're trying to meet?
So we look mostly for films that have some kind of Jewish theme. They might reflect Jewish life or Jewish culture, a Jewish story of some sort. And that's quite a wide definition. So the kind of films we have in the UK Jewish Film Festival are very, very varied. They might be blockbuster features. They might be quite niche stories from around the world. They might be documentaries, short films, animations, experimental films. It's really, really wide and deliberately so. But at the core is we are looking to reflect Jewish life, Jewish stories, and that is what is unique about the work that we have the privilege to bring to audiences here in the UK.
You see, the thing is that Jews, as a standard rule of thumb, are so good at infiltrating and getting involved in the film industry full stop. So why do we even need a Jewish film festival? Because surely there's so many Jewish influences on everyday films as it is that you'd almost think, well, actually, we kind of are the industry to some degree.
Well, it's interesting you say that. And it's certainly true that British Jews have been incredibly successful behind the camera. I would say that they have made great careers and had great success as commissioners, as producers, behind the scenes, I would say, in the TV and film industries. And at the same time, I think that all of us in Britain have carried that slight reticence to actually reflect that British Jewish perspective and British Jewish life on camera as well. So I think that that's something that's much more recent. We haven't seen that much of British life reflected on screen, and that's partly what the UK Jewish Film Festival can bring and contribute. We can encourage and support creatives, filmmakers who are prepared to dig into their Jewish identity and stories and who want to see that represented on screen, because actually there aren't many films and TV programs that do reflect that Jewish life. I think that's starting to change a bit in the last few years. We have seen, certainly on TV, a little bit more confidence in dipping into Jewish stories. You see mainstream programs like Friday Night Dinner and all kinds of things like that. You see a few more films. We have some interesting premieres from Britain this year, like David Leon's Orthodox, which is set in Stamford Hill. We have Doe, the tale of a kosher butcher and his Muslim apprentice. So there are some stories out there which we are starting to show, and we hope that we'll be able to see more of that in the future.
And those films that you mentioned, are they featured in this year's festival, are they?
Absolutely. Doe and Orthodox are both in this year's lineup. And also in terms of British films, we've got the hot news is that we've just secured the world premiere of The Green Park Hotel, which is a documentary which will resonate particularly for those who grew up in Bournemouth and who may have experienced life at the Green Park Hotel. It was after the Second World War, it was very, very glamorous. It was the only and the best sort of the Jewish kosher hotels on the South Coast. Everyone would pile down there for the summer. People would meet girls and boys, and a lot of life partnerships started at the Green Park Hotel. It's really the history of British Jewry in the 20th century, and that's going to be on Thursday, the 12th of November at Odeon Swiss Cottage.
What venues have we got in store for this year's Jewish Film Festival?
We are really keen to make sure that our films get to as wide and diverse an audience as possible. That means a Jewish audience, and that means the general public, because we want to share this unique film provision with all cinema goers in London. And one way we can do that is by making sure we're really out there in Northwest London and way beyond. So we will be at 11 venues in London, and that ranges from our opening night venue, which is the BFI South Bank. We're at places like the Barbican. We will be at Odeon Wimbledon in South London. We will be at Odeon South Woodford in the Northeast. Places like the Phoenix, Everyman Hampstead, Swiss Cottage. And we'll also be at the Mayfair Hotel for our closing night gala. So it's really important that we are really stretching out across London, and we're there for all of our audiences.
I think in that short answer, you have just quite frankly listed every notable and every worthwhile cinematic venue in London. That's extraordinary.
Well, I like that you said that. And one I forgot to mention was the Ciné Lumière, of course, in South Kensington, where we have four fantastic UK premieres as well.
So the standards are exceptionally high, and the festival runs from the 7th of November until the 22nd. What would you say, though, are your personal favourites, if you had to pick one or two?
It's a really difficult question always for the chief executive of any film festival to pick out highlights. We're very, very thrilled with this year's programme, but I would say that particularly interesting and strong at this year's festival are Closer to the Moon. It's a wonderfully inventive heist movie from Romania, actually, but the cast is entirely British. It stars Mark Strong and Vera Farmiga, American, and also Alan Corduna, Harry Lloyd. And it's based on the true story of a group of Jewish friends, former resistance members in Romania, who set out to rob a bank in Romania. It's a rather extraordinary story, but fantastic, fascinating film. Also very excited and privileged to be able to bring Son of Saul. This film won the Grand Prix at the Cannes Film Festival this year. It's probably the most important Holocaust film of the last 10 years, and we are very, very pleased to be able to bring this to our audiences. Of course, UK Jewish Film Festival is a big supporter of Israeli film. We have a huge amount this year. We have around about 35% of our programme is from Israel. Personally, I was fascinated by The Kindergarten Teacher from director Nadav Lapid. It's a very unusual story about a nursery school teacher who takes an interest in a five-year-old boy who is really something of a poet prodigy, and she is terrified that he will be corrupted by the influences of society, and that this talent won't be nurtured, and she sets out to nurture and look after him. Rather extraordinary and a very unique vision. And also, of course, The Farewell Party, which won the Audience Award at the Venice Film Festival.
Well, it all sounds intriguing, all sounds amazing. If people want more information, where do they go?
They should go to our website, ukjewishfilm.org, and they can look at our full programme online. They can buy tickets through all of the individual cinemas. They are selling fast. Do have a look as soon as you can. There's lots of interest, and some tickets are still left on sale.
Michael Etherton speaking to me there about this year's UK Jewish Film Festival, which, although started last night, it does run until the 22nd of November. To find out more, go to either the website Michael has just mentioned, which is ukjewishfilm.org, or if you can't remember that, then we'll put a link on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Sunday Jewish Radio.
You're listening to Sunday Jewish Radio on Spectrum Radio. It's now time for this week's Roundtable. I'm Clive Roslin, and joining Phil, Dave and me this week are journalist and author Emma Klein and The Voice, Jeremy Jacobs. The subject this week is inspired by the story we heard earlier on in the show about Willesden Cemetery being awarded a £320,000 grant to restore the historic site. We thought we'd discuss with our guests, what do cemeteries mean to them, and just how important is it to preserve them? Emma, let's start with you.
Well, my parents are buried in a joint sort of grave, although they died 10 years apart, at Hoop Lane Reform, at the section. There are other relatives who were buried in the Sephardi section of Hoop Lane, like my aunt. Another aunt was buried in Edgewarebury with donations from various family members because she had no children, you know, or no husband. And my beloved late brother is buried in Fortune Green Cemetery, which is fairly near where I live, but it's not a Jewish cemetery. But on the grave, we have some Hebrew, H. Hashem Li Veloira, from Adonolam. And whenever I sing Adonolam, I always think of my brother, and it almost brings tears to my eyes.
You know, that translates into two. It translates into my body and my soul with God. I face my future unafraid.
Really? I thought, yes, it means the Lord is with me, I shall not fear.
Well, it comes to the same thing, really. Okay, I suppose it's a different translation.
Yes, so it's fair to say that you have relatives all over the place in many different cemeteries.
In different cemeteries.
It's interesting you mention this because Edgewarebury Cemetery, yeah, I think, is very beautiful.
Yes.
And Hoop Lane, I think, is actually very dark, and it's not a pleasant cemetery,
well,
in my opinion.
My parents' grave, I haven't been this year, but I mean, it's you know, quite in a brighter part of it.
And Jeremy, you believe in cremation, don't you?
Well, I don't believe in it, but most of my mother's family have been cremated at Hoop Lane. And the reason for that is quite a significant one. A lot of her relatives, like many of our relatives, I'm sure, were buried at the cemetery in Plashet in East London. And that was bombed to smithereens in the Second World War. So my grandfather said, well, what's the point of being buried? What's going to, you know, because who knows what's happening in the future? So he was cremated, as was my grandmother on my mother's side, and many other relatives. On my father's side of the family, it's mainly burial. And my father, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year, is buried in Margate, one of the outlying Jewish cemeteries in the UK. And his stone setting is in the new year. And there's about 60, I think, graves down there, that's all. So I'm going through that process at the moment. But it's interesting. But in answer to your question, I think cemeteries are incredibly important because they help us to remember the past. In the same way, very much as the cenotaph coming up in the next few days, is incredibly important to remember fallen heroes of wars. It's very, very important because unless you remember your past, I don't think you have much of a future.
Speaking very personally, I agree with that entirely because I visit my wife's grave quite, not often, but I do at least once or twice a year because it does bring me nearer to the past and to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's so important about cemeteries, is that it is somewhere physical to go, a change of scenery that will force you to remember and reflect upon the person that you've lost. And as much as I understand why your relatives, Jeremy, were saying about cremation, what's the point if cemeteries are susceptible to being bombed? Well, let us hope that that's not terribly likely and that that won't happen anytime soon. But I think that to actually have a physical place that one can go to reflect and remember the ones that they've lost, I don't think you can put a price on that. Well, I dare say the cemeteries can put a price on it, but I don't think that, personally speaking, one should try and put a price on
it. It's very interesting, because my mother-in-law, in fact, she had my father-in-law cremated.
Really?
The rest of her life, she said, I've made a great mistake because there's nowhere where I can go and see him.
Right.
And please, she said to my wife, please, when I go, when it's my time, can I be
buried?
Yeah,
right.
But of course, the Sephardim have a very good way.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be cremated, they will allow you to be cremated, provided the ashes are then put in a coffin and buried.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, because I don't understand. I didn't think cremation was technically part of the religion anyway. I thought
it was supposed to be buried.
That's what I didn't quite understand.
The cremation was against the Orthodox.
Well, it is. That's why. Yeah. But according to the Sephardi idea, is that okay? The rabbi won't come to the funeral, but you can bury the ashes.
Yes, interesting. Yeah.
That's a good idea. I mean, where Dad's buried in Margate, next door is Ramsgate. The grounds there were Sephardi. They're closed now. But that's interesting. That's an interesting story.
What Alex was, who I was speaking to earlier on in the programme from the United Synagogue, was telling me, the reason why that the US feel that it's important to restore and try and refurbish, for want of a better term, Willesden Cemetery, is because not only the amazing number of people that are buried there, they were saying anything from Jack Cohen of Tesco's to some politicians and the Rothschild family are there, and also... Yeah, and also he was telling me that the most recent person to be buried there, well known as Michael Winner. He's buried in Willesden United Cemetery. And so, which I didn't realise. I actually thought Willesden Cemetery was closed. I didn't think you could be buried there anymore, but apparently not. But I think that he was saying that the main reason for that is that because it is getting to a stage of being a closed cemetery, it's really important to preserve it, because eventually what will happen is there'll be no relatives or no descendants of those who are buried there. And therefore, if it continues to get in rack and ruin, who's to say what the future of it will be? Mm. And it is, of course, really important based on who's buried there.
Of course. I've got this problem down at Margate at the moment. There are 3 or 4 graves there. They're in estate. But if you can't get... You know, I mean, who's responsible? If you know that there are living relatives, do they not have a moral, if not a fiscal responsibility, to make sure the gravestone is looked after? Mm-hmm. But some people, unfortunately, don't care.
Well, I don't know if it's don't care, you know.
Because many people don't.
It's the same. I mean, I could partially, my family could take the blame a little bit for what's happening in Willesden, because my great-grandparents are buried there.
My grandparents are buried there, yeah.
And I don't even remember the last time that I went to go and visit their graves. And the thing about my great-grandparents is that, and I found this terribly sad, that when I went to go and visit them, I was a bit shocked to see that they are buried in separate plots, because when they died, they couldn't afford, when one of them died, they couldn't afford to get 2 plots next to each other. So they're actually buried in separate parts of the cemetery.
Oh, right.
And I think that, especially if you go to somewhere like Bushy, which of course is a cemetery on an industrial scale, isn't it, really?
Mm.
You just don't see that there. Everyone is buried practically in dual plots. So,
well, it is, yeah. I mean, when my wife died, I bought 2 plots, one which one day I will go into next to her. And I mean, it's the obvious thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's obvious thing, but it never dawned on me until I saw this with my great-grandparents, that there were some people who probably couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
And it didn't even cross my mind. I just always took for granted that that's what people did.
It's an expensive business.
My husband was born in Slovakia, but grew up in Israel. And after the revolution, when the communists went down, we visited Slovakia. He had many photographs of ancestors' graves, and everywhere except one place we went to, everything destroyed, nothing remaining. But one place, a spa town called Piesczany, there were loads of ancestral graves. One went back to the 16th, I think late 15th or 16th century, saying Abarbanel Urban, because the family, my mother-in-law's matrilineal line, were Urban, like what must have come from a Abarbanel. And one of the relatives still living in Israel at the time told me, yes, they originally came from Spain. And then they went to Holland, I think, and then to Slovakia. And it was fascinating seeing these ancestral graves.
Indeed.
Whereas all the others were destroyed.
That's why cemeteries are so important. Right. One of the most famous cemeteries in the world is in Prague, yeah, from a Jewish point
sure,
of view.
Sure, sure.
And unfortunately, I now can't remember who it is who's buried there, but it's terribly, terribly famous in Jewish history, who is buried in there. And
that's a fantastic cemetery, the Prague Cemetery.
Oh, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah. And it's kept so beautifully. So I think it's a very good idea about Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Also, the other thing as well is that it's, as you were saying, Emma, when you were tracing your husband's ancestry, and to actually see a physical representation. Don't forget that to many people, a gravestone is the only physical representation of a past relative.
Sure, sure.
And so, therefore, if it's a relative that one has never met because they're from so many generations ago, I think it's quite moving to be able to go to a gravesite and be able to make connection with your past.
That's actually one of the most interesting things about Hoop Lane from the Sephardi point of view. Yeah. The Sephardim believe that every grave has to have a flat stone on top.
That's right. Yeah.
Because the belief is that everybody is the same in death. There's no such thing as an important person, unimportant person. And that is one of the most moving things, to walk through that cemetery, which is, again, a very old one, and see all the famous names.
Sure.
But they're all lying in flat cemetery.
No, and my parents were buried in the Reform section, so it had a... No, it wasn't flat.
Oh, it wasn't.
Yeah. But of my aunt, my auntie Flower, who you knew, she is in the Sephardi section in a flat.
She's
She died much later, yes.
But that's fascinating that you say about how the Sephardim look at it, that everyone is an equal and that no gravestone must differ from the next one.
That's very good.
Because if you walk into an Ashkenazi cemetery, which of course is totally different, it's almost a battle of the gravestones to see who can be the most lavish, who can be the most extravagant and who can really stand out the most. And it's, to me, so distasteful, some of them. I really, really do think, I understand that people want to make a statement and to remember somebody to reflect perhaps the personality that they were. But seriously, some of these designs, who on earth thinks of half of the designs in the Ashkenazi cemeteries?
Oh, heaven knows. Well, sorry, that's a very bad pun. But, you know,
I like it, though.
That's okay. I thought you might.
Editorially, that stays.
It's funny you say that, because that's a process I've had to go through just recently. I don't want it that colour. I want the headstone this colour, and let's have white lettering anyway. I mean, so...
But then you find that a bit odd, choosing the colouring of the gravestone.
I know, but
it's a tombstone.
It's my father. It's my father, and it's, you know, after I've gone, there are my relatives, but you've got to consider that. But again, it's not about us, it's about them. And
that's true. It's about the people who've got to see it, I guess.
And it concerns me, talking about that, you know, where Dad is, but, I mean, there are other grounds all over, up and down the country, which are closed. I mean, there were grounds at Canterbury and at Dover. They're no longer in operation. And you sort of wonder what's going to happen to these places eventually. And if Wilsdon can have it, why can't those other cemeteries have them?
You know, you're right, because there's the Ramsgate Cemetery in which Sir Moses Montefiore is buried.
Well, no, he's buried in a mausoleum, which is separate to the cemetery. But that's something. But again, it doesn't make it. They're actually thinking of taking him to Israel. But
Moses Montefiore.
Yeah,
and that's interesting.
Quite honestly, I mean, okay, it's. As you know, I'm from there. There's very, very. It's hardly any Jewish people left in that part of the world now. So, what do you do? But I wanted Dad to be buried there. I could have transferred him to Bushy, but I think the cost was a bit prohibitive, to say the least. But I think it's important because it keeps my connection with the seaside as well. So there you go. Very, very, very opportune.
I tell you what I've always found really fascinating though about cemeteries is, and in particular Jewish ones, I have to confess that on the rare occasions when I've been to non-Jewish cemeteries, and I don't mean that disparagingly, I just mean that they might be mixed religion cemeteries, there might be church cemeteries, whatever they are, all the same, I've never found the same sense of peace and serenity as one gets in a Jewish cemetery, especially with somewhere like Bushy, where it's all, I think, because it's so vast and so widely spread over the green area of Bushy area, that it's just really calming and very relaxing to be there. And I think that it's the right atmosphere to have in a cemetery when one's going to visit relatives.
It's quite interesting you said that, because I think I would have agreed with you a few weeks ago, but quite recently I went to the grave of my aunt, who died at the age of 102 last year. And she was buried in a Jewish cemetery, which is also a Christian cemetery and a Muslim cemetery.
Where's that?
Everybody is buried in the same part of the cemetery. So you see the Jewish part, but you can cross the road and there is a Christian grave. It's in Walton in Surrey. It's nice in a way. You can see all the different religions together.
Yes.
I think that's something pleasant.
That's very interesting.
It is good.
That is very interesting. I mean, if I could be slightly controversial, I mean, years ago, someone's wife passed away. She didn't properly convert to Judaism, but the husband wanted her to be buried in the Orthodox section. Wow. It wasn't allowed. And that was the start of the fissure of the congregation down there.
Oh,
and I'm thinking...
Very sad.
It's just small-mindedness, in my opinion. But, I mean, that's what happened down in Margate, so what can you do?
I think that the only thing that I found a bit hard to fathom, I understand the reasons why, but I'm not sure I buy into it, is how if one wants to take something like flowers or something to remember somebody, I know that that's not permitted in Jewish cemeteries, but I can't say that I understand why it's not.
Are you not able to put...
Stones. You can put stones.
You put stones.
You mustn't put flowers. Flowers are not allowed.
I wonder about that, because it's fun enough at this aunt that I was talking about a moment ago, her daughter put a flower on the grave and nobody said a word about it.
Well, it's probably because it's not a strictly Jewish cemetery.
Maybe that's
the reason. I think that's what the problem is. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand that it's for religious purposes. My understanding, and I'm perfectly happy to be corrected on this, is that it's because that flowers represent joy in our religion. You see, obviously, chuppahs are always laced with flowers. And it's obviously around Rosh Hashanah and the other high holy days that flowers are used quite a lot to express joy. And I'm guessing that in a cemetery, it's obviously not the place you're supposed to be joyous. That's my understanding of why it's not allowed.
Actually, there's something very moving about the stones on a grave. And we go and visit a grave, and it's of somebody that you loved or knew and cared for, and you see the stones, and you see four or five or six go, and you think, how marvellous that four or five or six people have remembered this past person and have put a stone there.
Yeah.
To show that they've been.
Of course, just finally, I think one of the first times that my sister went into a cemetery, she saw one of these gravestones where you may recall that some modern ones have quite a lot of gravel on them, as it were, sort of coloured shale almost.
It's actually glass.
Is it glass?
It's glass,
okay.
Yeah. Yep.
And she mistook them for stones and she said, my goodness me, someone's had a lot of visitors.
Bless.
Sweet, okay.
Anyway, that's where we have to leave it for this roundtable. But Phil and I extend our grateful thanks to our guest, journalist and author Emma Klein, and the voice, Jeremy Jacobs. And now it's time for our weekly rabbinic reflection. Today it comes from Rabbi Jonathan Remain from Maidenhead Reform Synagogue.
I don't know if you saw the article in last week's Jewish Chronicle. It was by Rosa Doherty. She was writing about her experiences as a Jew in a non-Jewish school, and it really struck a chord in Maidenhead. That's my community. We have 800 households. It's a fairly young profile, and we have 158 children at our religion school on a Sunday morning. Now, what's fascinating is that most are the only Jew in their class, if not in their year, and some in their entire school. And we have found that there are four benefits to that. Firstly, having a real live Jew in the class who looks ordinary, acts ordinary, is really the best way of countering any anti-Jewish stereotypes amongst their peers. So having Jews present is an education for the non-Jews and counters the myths that can develop from ignorance and from not knowing any Jews. Second, each Jewish child automatically becomes an ambassador for Judaism, has to answer questions about Jewish life. Why don't you eat pork? Why have a new year in September? What's the Jewish attitude to the afterlife? And so they're impelled to find answers if they don't know the answers already. Third, it reinforces their identity as Jews. They learn to live in two worlds and effortlessly move between them on a daily base. They cope very well with being the same and being different. Fourth, it prepares them well for when they go off to university and find the outside world quite easy to navigate, rather than challenging or overwhelming. I wonder, could this be a better model than Jewish-only schools, both for a society at ease with minorities and for being a Jew within it? I have to tell you, I was astonished last year when I visited a school in Finchley in North London, which is an area, as you probably know, with a high Jewish population, and yet there was not a single Jewish pupil at the school. Why? Well, because they were all in Jewish day schools. And so all the other pupils, Christian, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu and secular children in that particular school, ended up seeing Jews all around them, but never actually meeting or interacting with them. And the result was social isolation. And this is all the more puzzling given what's been happening in Northern Ireland. We all know that the mistrust between the Protestants and Catholic communities in Northern Ireland is due to many factors and has a long history. But it's been underpinned by an education system that keeps the children apart. The consequences of segregated schooling has been reinforcing the stereotypes and prejudices about the other side, which has led to that dreadful sectarianism and violence. But if you go there today, you'll find the astonishing success story is that the integrated schools, which cater for both Catholic and Protestant pupils, the demand for places in those integrated schools has shot up. And that's despite a drop in the overall school age population in Northern Ireland. I wonder, could that have a message for us? And that, frankly, is why I sent my children not to the local Jewish school, but to a community school, because I reckoned it was important for my children to sit next to a Christian in class, to play football in the break with a Muslim, to do homework with a Hindu, and walk home with an atheist, and for my children to know them, and them to know my children. I don't really think it's healthy for children to be like Rapunzel, locked away in her tower, because isolation is a poor teacher for later life. And it's not healthy for Britain at large if the next generation grows up disconnected and produces a very segregated society. So, even if certain schools have very good academic results, we also have to think of the social consequences, partly for the good of the country as a whole, and partly for our own sake. For if there is social disharmony, then it is minorities that will be the first to suffer.
Thank you to Rabbi Jonathan Remain from Maidenhead Reform Synagogue for this week's Rabbinic Reflection. And that's Sunday Jewish Radio for this week. All that's left for me to do is to thank our guests, Alex Goldberg, Michael Etherton, Emma Klein and Jeremy Jacobs, who are on Roundtable, the team, and of course, you at home for listening. If you've missed any of this show, then you can hear it when, from tomorrow, it's available online on Listen Again. Simply go to spectrumradio.net. Remember, you can now hear the most recent editions of Sunday Jewish Radio at any time as a podcast. You can go to sundayjewishradio.co.uk or search for us in iTunes. Sunday Jewish Radio is an independent production recorded at the studios of Jewish Care in London and is produced by Adam Bradley and Sue Greenberg. I'm Phil Dave from the whole SJR team. Shavua Tov, and make sure you have yourself a very good week.